WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is syndicated columnist Joyce Maynard. She was a reporter for the New York Times when she moved to rural New Hampshire to start a family. She tried to keep up her reporting, but decided it was hopeless to try to investigate prostitution while carrying around her infant. It was then she decided to make her children and her home her beat. Each week, Maynard writes a newspaper column about her home life titled Domestic Affairs. The focus of her column ranges from the acrobatics involved in making breakfast for five to her ambivalent feelings about her father, who was an alcoholic. A continuing theme throughout her work is the difficulty of combining motherhood and career. Maynard has been chronicling her life since 1972, when she wrote a cover story for the New York Times Magazine titled An 18-Year-Old Looks Back on Life. She was a college freshman at the time and spoke of her generation's unfulfilled expectations after the Vietnam War. Maynard's new book is titled Domestic Affairs, Enduring the Pleasures of Motherhood and Family Life. Welcome to Fresh Air, Joyce.
Hi, Terry.
Clear up a controversy for me. Pronounce your last name.
Maynard.
So we're bucking against the tide here.
No nerds in my family.
Okay. It seems to me what you're doing is finding a way to write about family life and a humorous way to write about family life without making family life sound like a sitcom.
Well, I hope so. I guess I'm hoping, too, that I'm finding, although I tell stories chiefly about my family and my children, the point of this book, certainly, and why anybody should read it is not to know them better, but because I'm looking always for the universal, the larger story that touches other people's experience as well.
Although I say that this is life that's not a sitcom, it amused me the way you sometimes feel like Donna Reed in the mornings when everybody's dashing out of the house after you've made them breakfast.
Well, I'm of that generation, and probably you are too, that grew up on Donna Reed show Leave It to Beaver, and I have indelibly etched in my mind this vision of mom that I don't come close to matching. I'm still sort of waiting to be like one of those mothers that I saw whose every hair is in place and who are always under control, never raise their voices to their children. And of course, they have a certain kind of child too who don't always match my own. And as much as I understand that that was fiction, that was television, it was still a shock, I think, for me when I became a parent, not only because of television, but I think the general sense all around for women of my generation that they should be able to do everything, to discover just how much of a struggle it is.
Well, you tried that for a while before you decided to write at home about home life.
Yeah.
You tried when you had one infant to continue your life as a reporter. Why didn't that work?
I had imagined, and I think this was a pretty common syndrome during the 70s, women in the aftermath of, or in the first wave of the aftermath of the women's movement, were led to feel a kind of responsibility to carry on absolutely as if being a mother had no bearing on their work life, probably more with greater toughness and determination than a lot of men. I remember, for instance, that when I left the New York Times for the reason of getting married and having kids, there were women who were very angry at the statement that was making and then the backward steps that seemed to suggest. But I did imagine, although I had left to have a child, that I would be able to carry on my work life with no discernible change. And what took me by surprise was not only the physical demands of a baby and how hard it is to leave them, find care you feel comfortable with, arrange for them, but that I myself was permanently a different person and my concerns were different. And rather than completely abandon the only work I've ever known, I made my home my beat, as I say in the book. And I attempted to find significance in the ordinary instead of, as a reporter does, the extraordinary.
Did you for a while feel like this was a sign of failure, the fact that you were giving up on the kind of reporting that you'd done before?
Oh, sure. And I feel sometimes a wistfulness still. I would have friends in the city who would be jetting off to some war or other, and I would get a postcard from some exotic spot, not only just in work life, but my husband and I had many friends who were leading much freer lives than our own highly domesticated existence, and we'd see them go off on their adventures, and I would feel very homebound, very unadventuresome, rooted. And I guess I sometimes have had to work to look for where the adventure was in child raising. Increasingly, it's apparent to me.
See, the thing is that you make it more adventurous by writing about it.
Well, that's true.
Because you make it into something larger than it is. This always happens, I think, when you write about something or make a TV show about something.
I don't think I make it larger than it is, but because, I mean, I think it's as important as I say it is. But I do have the opportunity that people who are simply living it don't have, which is to sit down and analyze it. And often I don't know the significance until I've done that. Which is why I think it's sometimes helpful for people to read these stories and say, oh, yeah, that's what that was about.
Joyce Maynard is my guest. She writes a syndicated column called Domestic Affairs, which is also the title of her new book. For me, the most moving essay in your book is one about the last visit you made to your grandmother, and you brought with you your young daughter. And after that visit, you were thinking about the four generations of women in your family, yourself, your mother, your granddaughter, and your baby, your grandmother and your baby daughter. And I'd like to ask you to read a paragraph from that.
Sure, with
essay.
Pleasure. It's a paragraph, it's an essay really, about the way family patterns perpetuate themselves, and I see it every day of my life still. On the plane flying home with Audrey in my arms, I thought about mothers and daughters and the four generations of the family that I know most intimately. Every one of those mothers loves and needs her daughter more than her daughter will love or need her someday. And we are, each of us, the only person on earth who is quite so consumingly interested in our child. Sometimes, when she was a baby, I would kiss and hug Audrey so much she started crying, which is in effect what my grandmother was doing to my mother all her life. And what made my mother grieve, I knew, was not only that her mother would die in a day or two, but that once her mother was dead, there would never again be someone to love her in quite such an unreserved, unquestioning way. No one to believe that 50 years ago she could have put Shirley Temple out of a job. No one else who remembers the moment of her birth. She would only be a mother then, not a daughter anymore.
I want to pick up on something that you say in there, that mothers love and need daughters more than daughters love and need mothers. What made you think about that?
Well, that particular day, I know it was seeing my mother's, feeling my mother's loss of her mother. But at the same time, the older my children grow, well, I'll backtrack and say that when they're babies, they just need you and want you. And then from the moment of their birth, they're beginning to cut first the cord and then a whole succession of other leave-takings and partings. And at some point, the switch occurs when I'm the one now, and it's already happening. It's happened with my daughter more and more. It's already happening even with my youngest son, that I'm the one who stays home and waits for him and hangs on his words to find out what happened at daycare or nursery school or the birthday party. We give out and give out and to our children, and they don't really give back to us. They give on to the next generation. It's a kind of love without strings. It's very different from marriage. I'm often aware of the fact that one can divorce a husband or wife in a way that you don't even think of it with a child. And it doesn't mean you love them less, but differently, that's for sure.
Now that you're a mother of three, do you relate to your own mother differently, especially in the light of this realization that you had that mothers love and need daughters more than daughters love and need
yes.
mothers?
Well, I think I'm sure I'm not the first person who said that. I felt much more sympathy and understanding for my mother since I've had children. I carry my own childhood with me every day, both what I want to duplicate and what haunts me that I want to do differently. I sometimes hear my mother's voice coming through myself in a way that's a little scary, you know, just silly little phrases, you know, what you touch, you take, or you know, that careful, your face might freeze in that position, or you know, all the little sayings that we hated our mothers to say. You know, I can tell you need to go to bed. You're overtired, and then the child cries, and see, I told you were overtired. I remember how I hated that one. It hurts me more than it hurts you. Spank you. Yes, I feel a kinship with the generation of parents, as whatever age you are, until you've had a child, unless you've had a child, you are still in the child generation, I think. It's, among other things, I think it's a fairly successful cure for a troubled childhood to become a parent. Then you can replace troubled parenthood with troubled childhood, if nothing else. The preeminent experience becomes being a parent and is no longer childhood.
So when you find yourself saying things to your children that your mother said to you, things that you swore you'd never say if you were a parent, do you stop yourself in shock and horror?
Well, I write about it. I write to the typewriter and write about it. The other thing that happens is I will hear my daughter speaking to her younger brothers in a voice that is me, you know, and I'll hear how I sound or how I sound to her, which is horrifying. Very dictatorial, you know, frequently and almost comically teacher-like. I mean, one has many different voices, but one of the great tricks about parenthood, I think, is that nothing is absolute and forever. Well, I suppose maybe there are some, but I haven't encountered a lot of situations that I didn't get a fresh start on the next day. So if I hear my daughter speaking to her brothers in that voice that is me, I can change.
You said that your mother raised you to be a mother, and I wonder if you feel like you're raising your daughter to be a mother, especially in light of the fact of all the new options that women have now in choosing how to spend their lives.
No, I'd say she's her own person, and I'm happy to say that. In fact, just the other night, we were discussing, I think my youngest son, Willie, who's three, was talking about the girl that he's planning to marry. And Audrey began saying, well, if I get married someday, not when, which was a phrase that I never uttered. It never occurred to me. And I think that's healthy.
As much as you really love parenting and being able to stay home and do your column there.
Oh, I hate parenting often.
Well, that's what I'm coming to, the fact that you actually also really hate it, and you describe several times where you're close to a nervous breakdown.
I love my children. I hate parenting often.
But you say something that we've all heard or said or both, which is, I'm just a servant around here. Mm-hmm. No one appreciates me.
Mm-hmm. I dress in rags while you wear a spree. That's another of my lines. It seems to come up a lot.
What are some of the things that move you to saying that, where you're at the point of saying, no one appreciates me?
Mess. I must say mess around the house, and picking up seems to do it. I did. There was a recent occasion that I can't say I'm particularly proud of, when I finally just decided that I would announce that I would be eating my meals in another room in the kitchen, since clearly the family regarded me as a servant. And that, of course, then wails were broken forth from all parties. The situations at this point are often physical. My children are great. I have wonderful children, of course. They're perfect. They're young, and so right now my issues tend to be sort of physical ones. I'm at the Jane Fonda stage of mothering, you know, when it's a workout. I haven't yet got to that age of, I don't have a pre-adolescent or an adolescent yet. I don't have the kind of cerebral dilemmas as much, probably, as a parent of older children, although I'm beginning to see them even with my precocious 9-year-old.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll haven't entered the picture yet.
It, for me now, it's things like getting three children suited up in snowsuits, and then the third one needs to go to the bathroom. It's that kind of thing. It is just the constant, or I hope that this won't shock your listeners to hear that 2 days before I set out on this trip, which is, you know, about my book all around the country, our family discovered that we were totally infested with head lice, which means a kind of examination of your life that, of course, I do all the time in one way on paper, but this was the realities. Every sheet, every stuffed animal, every item of clothing fumigated, every head, of course, and then each lice egg, I have to say, removed one by one from the little heads. And, of course, the little heads are wiggling quite a bit as it's happening. So that's the sort of moment that leads me to announce that I'm having a nervous breakdown. And I did announce that. It's not the first time they've heard that.
And no, what's added to the seriousness of that when you feel that, it's, you can also be thinking, if it wasn't for all of you, I would be a star reporter.
That I wouldn't
what
do.
What I've given up for you. Do you
that
do
I wouldn't
you feel
do.
That?
There are a few just forbidden things to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I choose my artillery carefully, I would say. That might really hurt.
Now, why would you say, I'm eating in the other room because you treat me like a servant and not say, think
see.
Of what I've sacrificed
What's
for you?
What's the difference there? For one thing, that's not how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel that they treat me like a servant sometimes, and it's correct, they do. But I am doing what I want to do, and I would never want them to feel that they had taken away from my life more than they had enriched it. Actually, I wrote professionally for quite a few years before I had children, and I was much less productive then. And I often think about that. I look back on those years longingly, and I think about the novels that I would write now if I had that kind of time, and I could write an encyclopedia is how I feel. But I didn't have whatever freedoms I had. I did not have the kind of drive and motivation to say something that I feel I do now. So as much as they take away, and they do, they have also given me a reason to do the work that I do, and a kind of passion for it that I didn't, for my life, period, that I didn't have before.
Writer Joyce Maynard is my guest. Her syndicated column and her new book are both titled Domestic Affairs. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joyce Maynard. She writes a syndicated column about her life as a wife and mother of three in rural New Hampshire. Her book and her column are both titled Domestic Affairs. Her children, by the way, are aged 9, 5, and 3. Her daughter's the oldest, and the other two are our sons. I think you mentioned a few of the letters that you've gotten from readers, and the funniest one, I thought, you might not have thought this was funny, was the writer who said, after reading your column, I've decided to get a vasectomy.
Oh, sure. A man. Well, of course a man. And I'm sure he made the right decision. It's funny because I knew exactly which columns he must have been thinking about. And those same stories that led him to the vasectomy clinic, I thought were wonderful examples of the richness of parenthood. But it just shows that it's all in the eye of the beholder. I get wonderful mail. It's one of the reasons why I write the column. At the moment, I have a fascinating batch of mail because for the first time, I asked readers to write into, I mean, they do anyway, but I asked them to write into me on a particular subject. The subject was adultery. And I have to say that I did this before Dear Abby did, and that I think I got a higher class of response. Very articulate letters, if not in her million numbers. But anyway, I'm sitting now surrounded by about 800 wonderful letters from the same people who, you know, who write to me about carpools and daycare centers and babysitters, writing to me about love affairs. It was what I was kind of guessing anyway. But it was fascinating to hear, and important, I think, to hear that these are mothers out there.
That brings up something that I wanted to ask you about, which is that I know a lot of women and a lot of men feel that before they decide to become parents, they really have to ask themselves if they would be willing and able to be a single parent, because a lot of people don't have that much faith in the power of marriage to endure.
Huh.
And
wow, I never asked myself that question.
But you never did.
I didn't embark on marriage with any degree of caution or circumspection. It is my temperament to wake up every morning and say, and this has not made my husband's life easier, as you can imagine, do I want to be married today? Pretty much, do I like my life? And I think that's dangerous and not a good idea. Luckily, I on the mornings when, and they occur when I say I don't want to be married today, I am able to make that leap of faith that there will again be a day when I want to be married, and it gets me through. And I take very seriously the notion of staying married. It's one of the things that this book is about, really, is the struggle of marriage, too. I think the children place, well, there are so many pressures on a marriage, but one of them for sure is this, the very same thing that gets us into the marriage often gets us out. You know, my husband and I were brought together, among other things, by a passionate desire to raise children together, to have a family. It seemed to both of us like an extraordinary adventure and challenge, and something we do very well together. However, I disagree with him on other things often. I never do with him as a parent. But by the same token, it has meant that we've been so consumingly involved with just getting through the days that it sometimes is hard, and easy, rather, to lose sight of one another. And I see a light at the end of the tunnel, but certainly an area that I address in the book is that I've witnessed the breakup of a lot of my friends' marriages over the now 10 years the other day that I've been married, and it's sobering. I never do with the smug sense of one who has it all nailed down, but I desperately, I think, quite apart from the fact that I love my husband, everybody knows that's not enough. I think we both take very seriously the notion of giving our children two parents married to each other. It's increasingly a rarity.
Well, your parents divorced after you left home, after you were old enough to leave home. Did that strengthen your resolve to not separate? Not, I'm acting as if you're on the verge of separating.
No.
Didn't mean it that way.
No. Well, I came from a troubled home. I mean, long before my parents separated. And I have often found myself, you know, practically proclaiming, we will be happy if it kills us. It's a top priority for me to be a happy family. I mean, of course, it doesn't work that way. That's not how you get there. But I am so much a product of my childhood that I can never live one day imagining that we are doing anything other than forming who our children will be when they're adults. And I take that with enormous seriousness.
You started writing professionally when you were still almost a child yourself. Your cover story in the New York Times, summing up the feelings of your generation, was published when you were 18 years old.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed even to hear it described that way. And, of course, it's a correct description. Presumes to make statements at the age of 18 that one wouldn't think of at age 33.
What were some of the things that you said in there?
I spoke of, I'm sure I said we of everything, you know, we, my generation, and I got a lot of angry letters, and I deserve to, that we were weary, that we had seen all of life at a very early age. I was ready for retirement, I said. I actually went on to write a description of the life that I hoped I would live someday, which is not unlike the life that I am living, down to the number of children. Not that I necessarily consider that number closed out, but was still very full of the 60s, the experience of growing up in the 60s. And I think that being as much of a television child as I was formed a great deal by national events rather than personal events. Now I wouldn't presume to speak for anybody other than myself, and I really, I tell just the stories that I feel I have a business telling. And if there are larger implications, it's for other people to find them.
How is your writing going to change as your children get older? You have to worry not only about, quote, empty nest syndrome, but about your subject matter leaving home.
Right. I don't really worry about that one. I do worry about my subject matter. Well, I was going to say I worry about my subject matter being able to read, which is now the case of 33% of my subject matter. Well, I don't just write about my children, but I say that and then I take it back, because although only one of my children does now read, I'm painfully well aware of the fact that even those who don't will someday read what I write, and that I must begin to pull back from them in their lives, and I am. It's one reason, for instance, why I asked that question in my column. I'm trying to go beyond my own home area, because I don't think it's a good and healthy way for them to grow up feeling that they are constantly being observed. It's hard enough to be a teenager when your mother isn't writing about you, but I don't think it's really fair for a teenager to be written about in the way that I did write about my babies.
Recently, your town was one of the towns that was singled out as a possible home for a nuclear waste site, and you became very active in trying to prevent that from happening. And you wrote in your book that you did it because you thought to not do it would set a bad example for your children. What did you mean by that?
Well, we were looking at the prospect that our town, this home that we'd spent the last 10 years building, would be confiscated, that virtually our entire community would be taken for a high-level nuclear waste dump, first on the globe, first on the face of the earth. And the impulse for many people was to leave. To just bail out, because at best we'd be looking at years of uncertainty while we waited to see, you know, if we did get to become a dump. And one of the compelling arguments that for my husband and me for staying and fighting it out, which we did, was what kind of a vision of life would we transmit to our children if what kind of message would be given them? I think every day as a parent, you wake up thinking, my actions are significant. What I do is how I look at the world is how they're going to look at the world. And it makes you think twice.
So you wanted them to show that you could take action against something.
At the same time that, you know, that we were doing this for them, it also meant agonizing amount of absence from them. It's hard now to convey what it was like, this town under siege, but we were every night out at meetings and demonstrations of one sort or another. We had been told that we had 90 days before a trial, and that basically we would have no say on whether our homes were confiscated or not. It was a period of semi-hysteria for many people.
And so your town is in the clear for now, though, right?
For now. Although the nuclear waste continues to be made, and it's got to go somewhere, of course.
Joyce Maynard, I want to thank you very much for sharing some about your life and about your writing with us. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
My guest has been Joyce Maynard. She's a syndicated columnist. Her column and her new book are both titled Domestic Affairs. Her book is subtitled Enduring the Pleasures of Motherhood and Family Life. It's published by Times Books. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.